Welcome back, everybody. It's time to meet our community, the Hispanic business community here in Orange County, powered by the Orange County Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beal Applied Innovation Center, all of which will make sense in a moment.
That's right. That's right. Welcome, everybody, to our community podcast show powered by the Orange County Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I'm your host, Senior Vice President John Gutierrez. And with us today, we have another special guest, Mr. Dr. Jose Mayorga, who is the Executive Director, Medical Director, of course, of Family Health Center, which we'll go over what an FQHC is at UCI Health.
He's Federally Qualified Health Center.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right. Associate Clinical Professor, Department of Family Medicine, Associate Clinical Professor, Department of Clinical Pharmacy Practice, and many, many more titles. Welcome, Dr. Mayorga.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure. I think it's been a while since we've been talking about getting this done, so here we are.
Yes, you're a busy man, and busy is good because obviously I want to give everybody a quick fact here, and I know the numbers have grown and changed, but Dr. Mayorga has positively impacted the lives of thousands of adults and children in Orange County. In 2023, the centers in Santa Ana and Anaheim provided care to nearly 29,000 predominantly Latino patients, 97% of whom live below the federal poverty level. Of those served, 27% were children, probably more, right? That's the number has gone up?
Yeah, absolutely. The number has gone up. Now, looking at information from this past calendar year, it's at over 29,000.
29,000.
Yeah.
Wow. And you know, we're going to get into all that because I know these clinics, I've been to them. You have an amazing staff, first and foremost. So shout outs to them. If any of them are watching, thank you for all you do, because it takes a village, right, to do what you guys do.
It really does. And I mean, kudos and a lot of congratulations to the team. There's about 200 people that I have the pleasure of overseeing doing different roles. And so we can't do what we do every day without them. So.
How many different centers are this is through the UCI health system?
That's correct. There's two clinics, one in Anaheim and one in Santa Ana. They're federally qualified health centers. They're the oldest designated FQHC in this county of Orange.
And what is that, FQHC?
Well, a federally qualified health center is an entity, it's a non-for-profit that's typically gains this designation from the federal government, and its purpose is to provide care in medically underserved areas that have been identified by the government. So there are approximately 1,400 or so across this country and its territories, so including Puerto Rico, Guam, there's FQHCs there. And so there's not a single state that doesn't have one. And we collectively as a group, so people could appreciate the magnitude of this, we serve 1 in 10 adults, 1 in 8 children across this country, serving over 32 million people. In these 1,400
designated. People, I'm just asking a few more questions
sure.
to get them other
people. Paul, can you let me focus? We got to get back to Dr. Mayorga.
I got to ask two questions. One is, how many there are?
Yeah.
Do the people who come there, do they have to pay? Is this through Medi-Cal? Are they funded by something? Or is this just a free clinic that's funded by the federal government? And,
so,
and I don't know, whoever their partners, like UCI or something.
Yeah, you know, we are not free clinics. There's specific policies and procedures we follow at the direction of the federal government. The premise, the fundamental mission of these federally qualified health centers or FQHC is to provide care even if people don't have the ability to pay. And so they are mechanisms in place. If you walk into my clinics right now in Santa Ana or Anaheim, a clinic out in Massachusetts, one in Alaska, one in Puerto Rico, and you say, I want to be seen by your doctors today, they will say, okay, let's figure this out. If you don't have the ability to pay, we will still see you. We will not deny you care. So it's a very unique structure that has been around since the early 70s, by the way. This is not something new. Mm. It's been around since the early 70s.
And I got to say, if anybody hasn't been to any of the clinics, I encourage you to go out and take a look, take a tour, because I've taken the tour. And a lot of our listeners or viewers may also be, of course, business owners, entrepreneurs, obviously corporate people that watch our show. And it's so important that you all take a tour, visit Dr. Mayorga and meet his team and see what the clinics are doing in the community, the impact that they're having. Because it isn't until you go and you visit the clinic and you see the different departments, right? Like the one in Santa Ana, right? You were showing me there was just different components there, right? Serving, I think you even have a dental section there, right? I think.
Yeah. And our health centers are very unique. Again, we're the oldest in Orange County. We're by physical location no longer the largest, but again, we see over 29,000 unique patients this past calendar
year.
Tell
us a story. Give us a story of a kid or somebody you helped here.
It's impactful, Paul. I mean, one of the things that always comes to mind is the stories I hear, particularly from our pediatric department. Some of our pediatricians have been there for multiple generations. They are literally taking care of, families now on their grandchildren. So they took care of the mom, the grandma, and now the grandchild. So it's very, the continuity, the delivery of care is absolutely.
But it's also shows that you're doing a good service, a great service in the community, because why would those families, right, continue to come back generation after generation after generation, right? Obviously, you're doing something right, because if not, they would have gone to other places, right? I mean, that goes to show that there's trust there.
Yeah, and I think that's the most important thing. We try to convey trust to our patients in our community, and we're, because we are part of the community. And I think, John, you mentioned earlier, encouraging folks to come visit. We love partnering with folks because at the end of the day, we can't do what we do because these are people that work, in our community. They're the ones that are out there seeking out services throughout the county and, obviously maybe working for some of the folks in the chamber.
Yes, we want to find more people to also, just support, sponsor, be involved with a lot of the stuff that they're doing through their nonprofit side, right? Mm-hmm. I know you're, I don't know if I should say it's passion, but for whatever reason, obviously, we know in the Hispanic community, there's a high level of people battling diabetes, right? And so can you share a little bit about that, right? That whole project that you got going on with that?
Yeah, we have a lot of diabetic patients. And unfortunately, this is very rampant across our Latino community and across this country and frankly, the world at this stage. But one of the unique things of being able to deliver care in this structure of an FQHC is we could be innovative and creative. And so we've been able to enhance the care of diabetic patients, bringing the community together, bringing them together during an actual visit. So we call it a group medical visit. But just imagine a group of folks, anywhere from 10 individuals to 12, sitting around having and struggling with diabetes and just sharing their struggles mm-hmm. and talking about how they're battling this disease to mm-hmm. manage. I mean, they're talking about, I couldn't stop eating those tortillas or, I really wanted to eat that pan dulce and that sweet bread, but
say that. Yeah. That's my weakness, brother.
But we haven't had lunch, right, John?
Yes.
So these are the conversations they're having, and they're talking amongst peers, and they're supporting each other. And our clinicians, our nurses, our doctors, our social worker, our dietitian are there, guiding the conversation, but they're the ones treating themselves, and that's what's really unique. We take it one step further. We try to show them how to cook healthy, and we try to describe food as medicine. And just because we tell you as a doctor, hey, you got to eat healthy, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean you can't prepare it like, your traditional cuisine, your Latin cuisine, Hispanic cuisine. There's ways you could do that.
I know this. Me being pre-diabetic, I can tell you that a dietitian played a huge role in my life, aside from the fact that, thank God, my wife was also like, you can't eat that. You can't eat this. You got to eat this, right? She was making me egg whites and spinach and things that at the time when I had to lose those 40 pounds or 30 pounds because the doctor said, hey, you got to cut back. Your A1C is really bad, right? Mm-hmm. For me, that was so important when the dietitian would call me and say, hey, portion control, right? Yeah. Watch your eating habits, right? And I noticed that. To your point about people gathering and maybe listening to each other, mm-hmm. that is great because I learned on my own that I couldn't allow myself to not eat on a regular schedule because if I let the time pass, I would get too hungry, mm-hmm. like so hungry that I would now eat a whole burrito, which is not good for my sugar levels, right?
That's right. And these burritos are not small.
Exactly. So I had to teach myself to not eat the whole breakfast burrito, to eat half of it, right? And then save the rest for later. So eventually, I had all these like, because I'm always in meetings. So I had all this to-go food with me. And people, they question you. They kind of put you on the spot like, hey, aren't you going to eat your lunch? you know, we're in this meeting, right? And, yeah. and as a, you don't want to have to share that. Like, well, I'm pre-diabetic. I got to watch how much I eat, my sugar levels. And so the pressure of having to deal with those kind of questions, right, yeah. on the spot, mm-hmm. you know, maybe at a family house. Hey, no te vas a comer el chocolate con el pan and blah, blah, blah,
oh,
right?
100%. Right? Yeah, no, and that's a, and that's
how to deal with those situations.
And those situations are really interesting because it just, it brings me back to some, you know, personal situation, right? You know, yeah. when I go visit my parents that live in Chino Hills, you know, traditional Mexican mom, you know, my mom will say, mijo, you look too skinny. No estás comiendo. You're not eating enough.
Yeah.
You know, you need to eat more. Yes. It's a natural reaction in our culture
yes.
to tell people, hey, you need to eat. We want you to come and eat. Even though I've already eaten, I have to sit down and eat again, right?
Yes.
That's a tradition out of respect. Mm-hmm. I'm sure many Latino, you know, folks listening appreciate that. But again, this group that comes together, you know, they're able to kind of work through some of these challenges and discuss, like, how do we approach that? And one thing you pointed out, you know, you mentioned your wife, you know, being a huge supporter. Listen, most of our patients, we always try to encourage and empower our female patients because most of them are the head of the household, frankly.
Mm. Yeah.
And how they do, the rest of the family will do.
Wow. Interesting.
And so that's something we try to empower them, right? You know, like I mentioned, we try to teach them to cook healthy. You know, hopefully they could take those recipes home and feed the entire family a more healthier.
Paul's dying for another question here. Go ahead, Paul.
Go right
we
ahead.
We had somebody in on another show the other day. She's from Argentina. She's a professional chef who gave it up to be a mom, a stay-home mom, and then became a nutritionist and other things, and insists on teaching people and her kids and feeding her family real food. That means no chicken McNuggets. I don't know what part of the chicken the nugget comes from here. Or hot dogs, or it's all just mushed together or something, leftover stuff.
Yeah.
Or Oreos, or Kraft cheese. Or you know, we, as an American society, not just a Hispanic society, are flooded with fake food that is all processed and put together.
But that
can't be good either.
You can't blame. That's my opinion, and I'm pre-diabetic, and I can tell you this.
Sure.
When I was told that I was pre-diabetic as a former athlete who grew up playing football, running track, playing basketball,
right, healthy.
I was very angry at myself. Mm. I remember standing in the mirror in my bathroom, literally angry at myself. Sure. I was disappointed in myself, right? Yeah. And I said to myself, you can't blame this on society. You can't blame it on... No, it's accountability,
yeah.
right? It's on you. You know that in our families, there's people that are diabetic.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had an uncle who was diabetic. I had family, you know. Yeah. So uno sabe. We know.
Yeah.
So you can't blame it on, well, don't buy it. Don't
but
buy it off the shelf.
Well,
don't
there.
Eat it. Yeah,
you know, the sugary
yes,
drink.
But it's accountability, right? Yeah. It's about being accountable. And I think that's where, you know, whatever it is, willpower. And like you said, if you educate the woman in the home, maybe then the kids will eat healthier. The husband will eat healthier, right? That's I love that. That's such a great thought process.
No, and it really is. And you know, one of the things that always comes to mind, people always think about fast food, you know, that's the term to share, that it's cheaper and healthier than eating healthy. I'm here to debunk that. That is absolutely false. It actually is cheaper to eat healthy. You just need to know how to shop. Mm-hmm. And part of what we do in these visits is we That's actually right. take a field trip. We take a field trip to a supermarket.
Yes.
And we show them how to read labels. We tell them, hey, these are the tactics. They're trying to sell you something that's really unhealthy.
That's
right?
good. That's good.
But let's focus
that.
Over here and concentrate on that. And by the way, let's be honest. We're not telling them not to eat what they enjoy.
Exactly.
The thing is be cognizant of how much you're intaking, when you intake it, and hopefully they'll get something out of those.
And to that point, when I was diagnosed with prediabetes, I used to drink a lot of soda. I used to drink 2-3 sodas a day, right? Yeah. And I quit, like, boom, like on the spot, Johnny on the spot. But I also knew I was going to go through those stages of having to drink a soda in weeks, right? And my wife remembered telling
withdrawal.
Me. Oh, yeah. I didn't want to say the word. But
that
I remember,
is a medical term. Good job.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
And my wife was like, you need to go take a walk because you're a little too cranky in the house, right? And it was true. I was going through the withdrawals. Right. And eventually I started drinking, you know, mineral water, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's certain mineral waters that you don't also want to drink because it has too much salt, right? So sodium's not good for you, right? Yeah. So I went to from Topo Chico to more Perrier or Pellegrino. And now I'm like, I drink mineral water all the time. I haven't drank a soda in almost like, I want to say like 3.5 years, right? I don't, soda to me is like my enemy.
You radical.
Yeah.
You're upending the system. Come on.
No. It's important to understand that what you're saying is so true, right? Like what we consume. Don't get me wrong. I still have a pan dulce here and there.
Sure.
I still have a donut here and there. I mean, I'm not going to lie about that. But I, at least I cut off all the soda, which was a lot of sugar I was drinking on a daily basis, you know?
And that's what, to me, is important to talk about with regards to health, right, in general. We talk about medicine being, you know, the top notch here in the United States. And I stress, you know, I have the privilege and honor of teaching medical students, as well as our family medicine trainees who are going to graduate, become full-fledged family doctors like myself and my colleagues. And it's so interesting having conversations with them because I remind them that 80% of what goes into their health, mine, yours, Paul's here, has nothing to do with what we got trained in medical school to do. Mm. All right? It's all so socioeconomically driven.
And yet we think there's a pill for everything. So if I have diabetes, I take a pill. If I have cholesterol, take a pill. And I continue to do what I was doing rather than address the underlying problem.
Here. Yeah. And that's in there lies the key. And that's why I come back to, like, we need partnerships with folks in the community who are experts, right? We know people that are experts on how to eat healthy, you know, where are the best ways to select the right health foods, or, you know, go
and
exercise.
Cook. I don't know. Do you know how to cook, Jen or John? I really don't know how to cook.
I'm
going to
be impressed if he says he can.
Mm. Can you really cook?
I make the best grilled ham and cheese.
No, you don't cook.
I'm not. I'll admit, I'm not. I'm a great shopper. I'm the guy who goes and shops. Yeah. I'm at the grocery store probably every other day. So I do the grocery shopping. My wife gives me the list, and I handle that part, which to me is, it really, believe it or not, I enjoy it because I have to get my 10,000 steps a day.
That's good.
So that's something I focus on, walking every day, walking, right?
Yeah.
So when you're pre-diabetic or even diabetic, obviously walking is important. It helps in many, right? Because my dad used to say, tentumes, your body just gets the blood flow, right? Mm-hmm. So walking for me helps me a lot, both from a physical standpoint, but a mental standpoint. It helps me with the stress.
You know what we're missing, though? Because I cut him off and I got into all the technical stuff. I want to hear his journey, his 10,000 steps to getting where he was.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Mayorga.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
You said you grew up in a traditional Hispanic household.
Yeah.
Were there other doctors in the family? Were there other people around?
No. There was Salvadores or maybe, you know, some curanderos, but nothing like that. In fact, I am the first physician in my entire family.
Congratulations.
So it's a big accomplishment. We traditional in the sense that we are not as traditional Mexican family. Actually, there's only two of us. I have an older sister who's 3 years older than me, and my parents both immigrated here from Mexico.
Okay.
And so, you know, Paul, do you really want to know from, like, did I come out of the womb thinking I was going to be a doctor?
I want to know how you got there, because I'll give you an interesting. He had somebody on from Girls Inc. the other day.
Yeah.
She went to the same high school he did in Santa Ana. And she said, when I came, I was just a so-so student, came time to graduate. She said, I want to go to college. Your counselor said, come on. No, don't go to college. Yeah. It's a waste. You're not going to do anything. Yeah. And she said, I want another counselor. She was told she couldn't get anything. She was limited in how far she shot for. Yeah. And she said, now she's the CEO of a big charity. And she said, why are we still telling these kids they can't, they can't, they can't?
Did you face some of those challenges growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll be very, you know, candid. Never in my wildest dreams I think that I was going to be a physician. We moved 3 times in my childhood. I grew up in Pomona. My parents felt that the right thing to do was to send us to private school, Catholic high school as well. And they sent me to very far. I mean, we ultimately lived in Chino Hills, but I was driving 45 minutes at that time to Rosemead to go to a private
high
school.
And what did your parents do? Was that an easy thing for them to do, or did they have to sacrifice to send it?
No, it was a huge sacrifice. My mom's a beautician by training. I mean, that was her career. My dad was an iron worker. So you drive through downtown LA right now, greater Los Angeles, he put hands on 50% of those buildings.
Oh, wow.
And so, for them to sacrifice what they did to get me to where I am today, I mean, I owe them everything in that regard. But to be fair, they sent me to that high school because I was going down the wrong path, wrong tracks. You know, they were worried about the influences that I had. And so, you know, I came out of high school with a desire to pursue the sciences. I will say, though, my first passion was to become an architect.
Really?
Believe it or not. I was supposed to be an architect.
Well, buildings, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, right? I just shared about my dad. I mean, to this day, I still enjoy it. Now, I mean, I always like to share. Although I didn't become an actual architect, I actually get a design delivery of healthcare. Particularly at our two clinics. You know,
so
it's very unique.
The most stunning story John's ever shared, you said it a couple of times. I think it's worth repeating is, I grew up in more upper middle class suburbia. Everybody had a job, everybody career, everybody went to college, right? John said, somebody, the teacher said, you're going to college, kid. You got something. I'm not going to let this waste. You're going to college. And he went home and told his parents, and they were like, no. You got to start making some money. You got to help support the family. What do you mean you're going away to college?
But I think his journey is different because your parents understood how important the education was.
Yeah.
That's why they sent you to a private school.
Yeah.
Right? They knew that education was important in your home, right?
Yeah, they did. And I will say, look, the private school education was very valuable. But I'll be very blunt. The elementary school I went to shut down. Mm. And I had first glance of what was happening there because my sister, who is a teacher for many years now, her first job was at our old elementary school. Mm. I walked in there, you know, to just talk to the kids, try to motivate them. Holy smokes, they were using same textbooks. They were sitting in the same desks that I was
in.
That blew my mind. And then just a couple of years later, they shut that down. So again, just because you were at a private school doesn't mean that it was giving you the greatest education. I mean, that's just my experience. I can only speak to that. But
after high school, where did you end up next?
So after high school, I had a choice. Either I was going to go to a small school called Woodbury University to pursue architecture, or I had the opportunity to come to UCI and where my sister was. So traditional Mexican family, she was sent to the University of California, Irvine. And so I chose to come to UCI because my chemistry teacher, you know, he told me at the end of the day, Jose, I think you really, there's something about you in the sciences. I know you love architecture. You will have that carry through your life. Trust me. And I was like, okay. And here I am. The rest is kind of the path I've taken going through UCI.
But the fact that your teacher said that to you.
Yeah.
Maybe a big difference in your life, right?
Absolutely. This is a traditional Irish gentleman, like had the full-on Irish accent and everything. And I don't know what he saw. He just said, Jose, you need to pursue the sciences. You got into UCI as a biology major. And I will tell you, that whole experience was a whole nother experience.
Biology, huh? That's tough.
Yeah, it's super tough. I mean, it is. And that was the interesting part. I stayed in a dorm here at UCI. Wow. I think there was about 20 to 25 of us who started as bio majors. When we graduated, there was only 3 of us left.
Wow.
So this just shows you how complicated and tough that.
They quit along the way.
Yeah.
Long nights, lots of studying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't miss those days.
No, not at all. Not at all.
It was like boot camp, right?
Oh, absolutely.
In the books.
Yeah. And then at the same time, right, like one always aspires to do other things. It's just the education, right? You know, obviously getting involved, doing things that in undergrad and then subsequently. Again, though, the crazy part is I didn't think I was going to be a physician. I took all the courses to be a doctor, but it wasn't until my 4th year. You know, I didn't come out of the womb with a stethoscope around my head, right?
Exactly.
It was until my 4th year when I got the itch to say, hey, I think medicine might be for me. So that's kind of when I started.
And why family medicine? Why aren't you a heart surgeon?
Right? Yeah. You know, those guys make the big bucks.
Right.
You know.
Hey, it's not about the money.
No, not at all. Absolutely not. And that's exactly why.
It's the impact, right?
It was definitely the impact. I mean, part of the reason why I chose, it was ultimately between pediatrics and family medicine.
Yeah.
But I ultimately landed in family medicine simply because it allowed me to take care of my entire family.
Yeah.
And you know what? That was important to me. Obviously, I was able to see from, you know, cradle to tomb kind of effect. You know, that was important to be able to care for everyone across
like these health centers that you're overseeing.
You know, it's interesting about your story that I want to just point out. I remember a teacher once told me, you know, everything is about generational education. So the fact that, you know, your sister was already a teacher, it's interesting because they say that in your family, if you're somebody's already a teacher, then the next level is you got to be a doctor, right? Hmm. Or you got to be an attorney. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like you met certain standards, and you seeing your sister as a teacher was probably huge, right?
It's huge, right? It's absolutely,
because you're like, I can get to that level or whatever level is next, right? As a doctor, as a physician. But more importantly, you're both doing such good work, whether you're a teacher or you're a doctor. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you're helping people, right? You're making a huge impact, you know? And so, I mean, kudos to your parents, how they raised you as a family, mm-hmm. because obviously there was something they instilled in you, both from an educational standpoint.
And why?
But also from a compassionate standpoint.
What drove them? Why didn't your dad say, come on down to be the iron worker, I'll get you into the union? And
That was never a conversation, because, you know, he would wake up at 3-4 in the morning every day, mm-hmm. be at work before the sun rose.
It's hard work.
He would come back and I would see him. Like, there was a particular building that he worked on, the Disney Concert Hall.
Yeah.
And I remember this vividly. You know, I was a lot older when he was working that job. He would come sunburn every day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
No matter how much sunblock he put on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think it ever crossed his mind to tell me to go into the union and be an iron worker.
Yeah.
In fact, I think he was excited that I was going to be an architect, although he had words to say about architects and engineers, because he had to put things together that they designed.
What were they thinking of when
they did this? Exactly, Paul. Like, that stuff never works. Well, that's always been a fun joke.
Especially the Disney Concert Hall. That was nuts. It's curved walls and all sorts of crazy stuff.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What was that day like when you first started working as a physician and Hispanic families were walking in and they were like, wow, you're Hispanic and you're a doctor? Like, do you remember that? What was that like?
Well, there's very unique experiences like that, but I want to share the story about when I first was a doctor.
Okay,
right?
Let's go.
Because this
share that story.
So the story, you know, when you graduate medical school, you have maybe a few weeks before you start your training within your specialty, and mine is family medicine. I trained at the county. LA County system at Harbor UCLA. We call it Little County back then. Hmm. USC being big county hospital.
Okay.
So my entire medical school time, I wanted to deliver a baby like that. I wanted to have that experience, you know, just to say, hey, I did this, right? Like, I was trained to do it. I had studied it. I even took extra time to, even when I was at UCI medical school, to do that, and never delivered a baby. And lo and behold, the first rotation, the first experience in my training program as a physician now, was OB. OB in the busiest hospital in downtown LA, California Hospital at the time.
They're cranking them out every few seconds. So you've never done one. They're cranking them out like an assembly line.
Absolutely.
Hey, Paul, take it easy on the Hispanic.
Well, I don't mean just the Hispanic.
It's
county facilities. They've got tons of babies going through.
It was a busy hospital. It's right in the heart of downtown.
That's what makes our beautiful big Mexican families, Paul.
I guess
so. Our barbecues are not just three people. It's like 40, 50 people show up to the party, right?
That's true. That's very true.
So you got to experience this.
So it was such a look. Not only was it the first experience, but my first day was actually night. Mm. I was on night call.
Oh, wow.
So that means I didn't start till 5 p.m. and ended the next day at about like 9 a.m.
Oh. Right? How many babies did you deliver?
Well, it's definitely was more than one. but I tell you the story because it's still forever imprinted in my memory banks.
That one night. Wow.
I'm walking down the hallway where all the women are laboring. There's probably about 20 rooms. Mm-hmm. It about, you know, 75% of the rooms are occupied, and then mm-hmm. the rest were full by the end of the night. Okay. I walk by with my white coat on, in my scrubs, just mm-hmm. kind of just doing my thing. Nurse runs out of her room. She's like, I need a doctor in here, stat. And I just kept walking.
What?
And they're like, wait a minute, that's me. Like,
exactly. I paused, and I was like, wait, that's me.
Yeah, that's
so,
me.
So I turned back around.
I'm Superman. They're calling me.
Exactly. It was not a Superman moment at all.
Put the cape on. Let's go.
Oh, my goodness.
No, this is absolutely comical. So...
Were you nervous?
100%.
Were you kind of in shock?
Absolutely. I walk in.
This is a great story about a doctor's inside life.
Did you faint when he came out?
Did you get dizzy?
I don't even remember if it was a boy or a girl. Just wanted to see that much. But the funny... So
wow.
I walk into the room, right?
Yeah.
I take off very calmly, take my white coat off.
Yeah.
I start putting on, extra gear.
All the time in the world. Yeah.
So I don't get... The nurse goes, Dr. Mayuri, we don't have time for that. Just put on some pair of gloves. This baby's about to come out.
What?
And so, sure enough, all I had on were a pair of gloves.
Wow.
One booty that covers up, getting...
So you know, Paul, that means something that goes on the shoe.
Okay.
Don't get confused.
Cover my shoe and my one pant leg.
I know doctors live glamorous lives, so I don't know.
Yes,
what? So you're trying to put the Superman suit and you're like...
And she's like, let's go. This kid's coming.
And the nurse is like, let's go.
No time for a mask, folks. Nothing.
Wow.
So I get to the position to deliver this child. And,
catcher's mitt.
Oh, yeah. I wish.
He had his Yankee hat. Oh, Dodger hat.
Dodger hat. Come on.
He's like, come on.
Oh, my goodness. And so I'm there delivering this baby, and the baby's coming out. And I'm just kind of putting my hands where I guess I should be. And all of a sudden, I see these other two smaller hands reach over my shoulder. And it happened to be... Again, remember, I was walking down the hall by myself. There's no other physician there.
Yeah.
It happened to be the third-year OBGYN resident who's a few years ahead of me.
Thank you, Lord.
Yeah, probably. He leans in.
Wow.
He leans in. He kind of helps me guide through the process. Baby's born. Everybody's happy. Yeah. Grandma's there. Mom's relieved. And he whispers in my ear.
Yeah.
This is the best part. This is where it gets good. He whispers in my ear. He's like, Jose. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, did you ever play football? I was like, yeah, of course. He's like, hold the baby like a football because you're going to drop it.
So,
boom. Like all of a sudden I grab the baby and now I'm creating it like a football.
Yeah.
And I was like, I feel like a pro.
Not a good thing to drop the baby after.
Absolutely. You never do. You don't want to do that.
You know what? That's interesting if anybody's ever.
Wow. So then I hold this baby, right? And I'm saying congratulations, going through the motions of, and then presenting the mom with a baby. And, the mom, the grandma then shares to, out loud. She's like, oh, my gosh, this is my first grandchild. And I was like, congratulations, grandma. This is my first baby I delivered.
Oh, no.
Jeez. We don't want this guy.
We don't want this guy.
I would have picked somebody else.
That came out of my mouth.
What a great story.
Yeah, I've never done this before either. That's amazing.
Grandma looks at me.
Uh-huh.
And she says... Yeah, I could tell.
She really said that to you?
Yes.
No way.
Yes. No joke.
So I will say this. I got to say, nurses play such a vital role, right? I mean, in your whole story.
Absolutely.
People don't realize, obviously, people that know me as why I joined the chamber, we own a hospice company, right? And I always tell people, if it wasn't for our nurses, they're like, they're miracle workers.
They keep it going. They really know what's happening here.
And so...
Absolutely.
The thank big shot goodness she ran in. Out and was like, I need a doctor, right?
Yeah.
And here you are walking.
And thank goodness she said, hurry up. Come on. Yeah. We don't have time for...
You're the doctor. Let's go.
Let's go, Superman.
He's like, oh, wait, that's me.
Man,
wow, what a story, man.
That story, man.
So after that, you delivered more and more babies?
About 200.
200 to this date?
Yeah. I haven't delivered one on a plane. My career delivering babies ended after training.
On the side of the road?
No, I've never done those.
Out in the forest.
Wow.
Yeah, but
so by the time you got to the 100th one, you were just like a pro. By that, you were like, this is easy. I got this.
I want to know, somebody's listening right now, and they're going to tell us who that kid was.
Oh,
and that kid's going to call you up and say, I mean, what a great story. I was delivered by a guy who didn't really know what he was doing.
Maybe the mother of the kid, because I don't know that the kid's going to know.
Well, the most important part is I didn't drop the baby. Right?
Didn't drop the baby. That's the
most important part.
You know what? But nobody ever thinks of stuff like that. You never think, It's
don't
true.
Drop
like,
him.
Like the doctor and the babies are full of stuff, and it can be slippery.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, well, you're getting
there's a lot going on down there.
They got soft heads.
It's the football, literally at a football game full of mud at a football game with rain, and it's true. You can fumble.
When I was a kid,
we both play football, so we know you can fumble a football easily in the mud and the wet weather.
I'm going to date myself, but back in the 50s when I was born. They used to use forceps and other sorts to yank the baby and pull them out, and then you'd have these forceps impressions on your head.
That's
I knew
true.
Kids that had indentations on their head because they grabbed too hard when their
no
little
way.
Soft heads.
They did that?
Very rarely do they use them now. Extremely rare.
But yeah,
very
but
rare.
In the day.
So now you just use your hands to...
No. I mean, you guide. I mean, the whole point is, you know, and then again, this is not... Yeah. It's been a while, but, you know, there's techniques that you use to try to deliver
technology
the baby safely.
Technology and everything, probably not.
Of course, you know, you want to not have to use any... pieces of equipment to help deliver it.
You don't take a clamp and just yank them out.
No, I mean, you know, there are people that are trained still to do those and use those types of equipment. I mean, sometimes you have to do
but
that.
We had, there were kids in school, and you'd say, oh, yeah, you were one of those babies. They had an impression in their head. Their little soft skull got crushed, but they yanked them out.
Yeah. So did you, like, call your parents or family, anybody, your sister?
I did it.
And you said, I just delivered
at 2 in the morning?
No, I mean, like, I'm saying, like the next day where you like, I delivered my first baby?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I mean, of course I talked to them, you know, and they just kind of just, you know, that's fantastic. I mean, how could they put it all together, right? Yeah. They're just excited to me because they could sense the sense of excitement and enjoyment in my voice. But, yeah, I mean, it's the rest is kind of...
And I got to say, to be a physician, you have to have a strong... I guess you could say stomach, because when I was there, when we were having our kids, right?
You're the guy that faints. Huh?
I was like, whoa, like just everything.
There's a lot going on.
So for those of you that have never had a baby, right? Like as a parent, for the first time when you have your first one born, you're just like, whoa, you know, there's a lot going on. So as a physician or a nurse, I mean, you got to have that strong willpower to just, let's go, let's do this. It's game time,
and
right?
Yet it is.
Yeah.
An assembly. I got to say, I'll tell you my quick
story. An assembly. In those days in Detroit.
When my last grandchild was born. Now, understand, my wife and I never had a child. We adopted a child. So she didn't give birth,
we're
right?
Past time already.
I know, we're way past. And so when our grandchild comes out, this is the first time I've ever seen it. My daughter was adopted, right?
Yes.
Somebody else went through that experience when she was born. So my grandson comes out. And like he's saying, helter skelter, he's coming, it's crazy. And normally they'd make you go in the room, but there's no other time. Just stand over there, Grandpa, and get it out of the way. But this is happening right now. Boom, 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 boom. And ta-da, it comes out. I thought, this is like a miracle. I expect God, the heavens, to open up, his sun to come down, and there, a child has been born. And everybody treated it so normal, like, what's you so excited?
Well,
we're doing this every 10 minutes here.
Yeah, first and foremost, kudos to all of your team, yourself, obviously, all the doctors, everybody that is doing. I mean, obviously, we went through the pandemic, and it was such a tough time for many people. So thank you all for all you do and all the healthcare heroes that are surrounding you, of course. And like we said, to anybody out there that's listening or watching today, please reach out to Dr. Mayorga's office. He's both between the Santa Ana office there, the clinic, and in Anaheim. They got so much good stuff.
If he's not
doing.
Teaching other doctors, because he's a associate clinical.
But you got
professor.
A great team, right? They can come down there.
Oh, yeah,
you got
no.
a great team.
We have a great team. Love to have people visit. I mean, we do quite a bit of tours. Just people should know what we're up to.
Right?
We're excited to kind of share the amazing work.
And you're right there in the heart of Santa Ana. I mean,
right there in downtown.
Yeah, right there in the heart of Santa Ana.
And I know there's going to be a lot, we're not going to get political, but there's a lot of debate going on. What is the federal government's role in all this? Should we fund it? How do we fund it and everything right now?
Well, that's another show, Paul.
I know.
We'll get into that.
So
we're already past our time.
I'd love to see what's happening. I don't really know.
All we can ask right now is that all those viewing and listening, please support what they're doing. Dr. Mayorga is not only a physician, but he's really a community leader. That's why we wanted to have him on the show. And you know, anything else you want to share, anything else coming up, obviously there's a lot going on, but, you know, any other events or fundraisers that you would like to share before we head on out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're in the midst of really trying to continue to expand our services for diabetes and impacting the community. So there are things that we're hoping to raise funds for, of course, you know, particularly around how to make sure people have access to healthy options for food are important to us as well. So there's a lot going on around the strategies of growth and expanding, because we're making an impact and the team does amazing work, and so we're not finished, and we've been doing this at least under, you know, the grace of God, 6.5 years now, myself doing this work here back at UCI. So,
well, thank you for all you do, and thank you to your team, and thank you all for tuning in. Unfortunately, we run out of time. We're having a lot of fun here, telling a lot of great stories about your...
Don't drop him.
Yes, don't drop the baby first delivery. I think that's a great story.
Don't do it.
Continue all success. Thank you all for tuning in. Mr. Paul Roberts, take it away here on our community podcast show, powered by the Orange County Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
All right. Don't drop them. That's the story of the day here. As we continue to meet our community here on Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beal Applied Innovation Center. Brought to you, powered by the Orange County Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.